Next, we'll hear the latest safety information about the top cosmetic surgical procedure in the United States, breast augmentation. Last year, silicone implants were used in 60% of those operations. Back in the 90s, you may recall, those implants were pulled off the market because of safety concerns. Years later, the Food and Drug Administration said the implants posed no serious health risk. Then, about 2 weeks ago, the FDA offered new safety information drawn from ongoing studies. Reporter Gretchen Kudakroen has the story.
The FDA report says silicone implants are generally safe, but complications from implants are frequent. Things like hardening of the skin around the implant, ruptured, wrinkled, or lopsided implants, scarring, pain, and infection. As many as half of patients will need to have additional surgeries or have the implants removed in the first decade. It also turns out that the longer a woman has the implants, the more likely she is to experience these complications. Take Kate Marion. She had silicone implants for breast augmentation in her late 20s, and just shy of 2 decades later, she noticed something unusual.
I noticed that when I was crossing my left arm across my body, I would make a little noise from my armpit, the way little boys do when they stick their hand in their armpit and pump their arm up and down. Little tooty noise.
An MRI showed both her implants had burst. Her doctor immediately recommended removing them, which she did. Marion hasn't suffered any apparent harm from the ruptured implants, and she even confesses to having an occasional twinge of regret that she didn't have them replaced when she had the old ones removed. But ultimately, she decided she didn't want to go through more surgery.
Well, how long would these next ones last? I'd be in my 60s when I had to do this again. Who wants to have surgery unnecessarily when you're 60-something?
New York City plastic surgeon Matthew Schulman says with the current implants, leaking is not a health threat.
The actual silicone that's within the implants is inert. So if the silicone gel leaks, it doesn't travel through the body, it doesn't cause systemic problems, so the MRI is really detecting a cosmetic concern.
There have been more serious outcomes. Annette Knecht got silicone implants in 1991 following a double mastectomy. For years afterwards, she felt ill, suffered multiple bouts of pneumonia, and had trouble breathing and pain in her chest. Doctors reassured her it wasn't the implants.
We had a CT scan done, and it showed okay. Everything showed fine, so we didn't worry about it.
But no one ever told her to get an MRI, something the FDA now recommends women with silicone implants get every few years. It turned out that Kinect's implants had leaked, and a biopsy found silicone in her lymph nodes and in her lungs. She's currently disabled and waiting a lung transplant. All, she says, for vanity.
We're about 4 generations removed from that implant.
Matthew Schulman says silicone implants have undergone big changes since the early 90s when Kinect received hers. He says back then they contained a runny liquid silicone.
The silicone implants of today, it's essentially like a jelly. So the jelly may ooze a little bit, but it will not run out like an oil.
There are plenty of satisfied customers among the nearly 400,000 women who receive breast implants each year. Even so, Schulman tells his patients additional surgeries are a very real possibility.
I say, you're young. Breast implants don't last forever. They may leak. They may rupture. You may decide you want a different size. So you have to at least expect that sometime in your life, you are going to need a reoperation. And if you are 100% against having another surgery in your life related to these implants, then it's something you should reconsider.
For NPR News, I'm Gretchen Kudakroen in Cleveland.
There seems to be something about the frozen vistas and the unpronounceable street names of Sweden that lend themselves to crime fiction. Stieg Larsson certainly proved the point with his hugely popular Millennium trilogy, which included The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. And now comes a new thriller, tapped to be this summer's Nordic hit. It's called The Hypnotist, and it's the work of Swedish writer Lars Kepler. Except, turns out, Lars Kepler doesn't actually exist. To help explain, we've invited Alexander Anderil and his wife, Alexandra Coelho Anderil, to come into the studio in Stockholm. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
All right, so who is Lars Kepler?
Actually, I am Lars.
And I'm Kepler.
Because Lars Kepler is not Alexandra or Alexander. It's us two writing crime fiction together.
Because we writers in our own right here in Sweden, and we wanted to create a brand new writer when we started to write crime novels.
This is your first book writing together as a husband and wife
team.
Yes,
yes.
This caused, I gather, quite the stir, huge literary mystery in Sweden when The Hypnotist first came out. Hit the bestseller list in Sweden. Nobody could figure out who Lars Kepler was to try to interview him or her. I understand newspaper teams set up their own reporting squads devoted to try to figure out who Lars Kepler was.
Yes, it's true. And they even had a telephone line.
You
could call and give tips about who Lars Kepler was. And we were hunted down. 3 weeks after the publication, the journalist found us in our summer house.
So we actually wanted to stay secret forever. That was the idea, but it lasted for 3 weeks.
For 3 weeks and you were outed. Where did you come up with the name Lars Kepler? What does it mean?
Lars, it's a tribute to Stieg Larsson because we wanted to wave to him in the heaven of writers, and because we think that he did something really new with crime fiction here in Sweden.
And Kepler is from Johannes Kepler, the German scientist who solved one of his time's biggest riddles, the elliptic ways of the planets around the sun.
Talk to me, both of you, about how you actually wrote this. How do you write a novel with someone else? Do you trade chapters back and forth or sit next to each other and brainstorm? How do you do it?
We have wanted to write together for several years, but every time we tried, we ended up in big fights. So it's not that easy to write together.
This was a kind of marriage therapy, I gather, to
Yes.
But
yes.
I think this pen name, Lars Kepler, helped us to work together. And that was a key to our creativity together. As soon as we created him, we
were happy
again. we started to write, and we start every day with a tea meeting, as we call it. We drink. Well, Lars Kepler preferred tea. Me and Alexander, we
are coffee drinkers.
Yeah, but Lars has to have his tea.
How far do you take this? Do you actually brew a cup of tea for Lars Kepler?
Oh, yes.
No, not for him, but for us.
No, for us. But
yes.
Yeah, he has to have these lemon biscuits.
As well, yes.
Yeah, so, well, it's a bit strange. But during these meetings, we
discuss the plot.
Yeah, we put a lot of notes on our kitchen table and discuss the plot.
Well, let me ask you a little bit about the book itself. It opens with a very brutal murder of a family in Stockholm. The only surviving witness to the murder is the teenage son in the family, who is in critical condition, too weak to talk. And the doctors and investigators in the case decide, we've got to figure out what this boy could say. They decide to hypnotize him to see if he can provide any clues to help identify the murderer. Why take the book in that direction? What made y'all decide to write about hypnosis?
One thing that we really were fascinated with was getting inside the head of the perpetrator, understanding behavior that is terrifying. And then we thought that a hypnotist can actually get inside the head of a person and see the memories and the hidden things.
And of course, it helped that my big brother, he works as a hypnotist, so he's a professional hypnotist.
Now, the violence in your book is largely carried out by women and by children. It's the women and children who are terrorizing victims in your book. It's an unusual direction to take a thriller.
Yes, I know. We had to write about things that really scared us in the real world.
It's really frightening. We have three daughters of our own, and of course, there's nothing more frightening than something bad happening to them. And also the thought of our children turning bad in some ways is another frightening thought.
But I want to ask whether there's something particular to Sweden that seems to lend itself to such dark crime writing. I mean, American readers, many of them will be familiar. We've mentioned Stieg Larsson, who had terrible violence, very entertaining books, but very violent. Your book, if anything, I would think is grislier than The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo trilogy.
Yeah,
you have to come here wintertime. You see, it's so
very
dark.
Very dark, very dark.
We don't even see the sun for several months in the north of Sweden, so.
Yes, but I also think that you experience a book as scary when you care for the people in the book, and then you don't want anything bad to happen to them. And that's how we felt when we wrote the book. We were so scared ourselves.
Well, and I think one thing with Sweden is that in some way the Swedish society is a very good society, almost perfect on the surface. That is something that makes the writers forced to see what is underneath the surface, because it's always something underneath the surface, of course. And it is about feeling safe. We do feel safe in Sweden. That's why we can
write these
terrible and explore what is frightening in the world.
That's Alexandra Coelho Anderil and her husband Alexander Anderil. They write together under the pseudonym Lars Kepler. Their new book is called The Hypnotist. Thanks so much to you both.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
You can read about the discovery of the young patient in an excerpt from The Hypnotist at our website, npr.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
From NPR News, this is Weekends and All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz. A couple of weeks ago, Sarah Bloom Raskin, a member of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve, gave a speech here in Washington. And the topic was the growing gap between rich and poor in America. And in that speech, she said something striking.
This inequality is destabilizing and undermines the ability of the economy to grow sustainably and efficiently. It is associated with increases...
We'll hear more from Raskin in a moment. Now, when Federal Reserve governors speak, they speak cautiously. Their words can move markets. But what Sarah Bloom Raskin was essentially saying was this. The economic recovery might be slow going for a long, long time if the income gap continues to grow. And how big is it? Well, the latest statistics show that right now, the wealthiest 1% of Americans earn more than 20% of all the money generated in this country each year. And the last time the gap was so wide? 1928. Right before the stock market crashed, leading to the Great Depression. That's our cover story today, the growing income gap, why it might be making the economy worse. In a recent issue of The Washington Post, reporter Peter Wariski wrote about a man named Kenneth Douglas, who was a corporate executive back in the mid-1970s.
He is the CEO of Dean Foods, which is a dairy company that has become one of the largest dairy companies in the U.S.
Kenneth Douglas was, by all accounts, a talented CEO.
The company was doing great. Profits are going up very quickly. Revenues are going up very quickly. All of these good things are happening to the company. And the board, his board of directors said, Ken, we want to give you some more money. And he would say repeatedly, no, he was making enough.
Douglas thought it would be bad for morale. Besides, he was happy with his pay. His compensation package in today's dollars was $1 million a year. Douglas had a nice three-bedroom home in the Chicago suburbs. He had access to a company car, membership in a country club. But that was the 1970s. Today, things at Dean Foods are a lot different, especially for the current CEO, a man named Greg Engels.
So he has averaged about $10 million a year, 10 times as much as Ken Douglas. And he lives a much different life.
How so?
Well, he's got a $6 million house in Dallas. He's got property in Vail. He's got membership in four different golf clubs. He's got a corporate jet. Ken Douglas, back in the 70s, had a Cadillac. But it's just a whole new level of executive grandeur that we see today.
Greg Engels is hardly an extreme case. Last year, top CEOs saw their pay rise by 23%, according to a recent New York Times study. The average worker, a pay increase of just 0.5%. And corporate executives now account for most of the very richest Americans. Peter Wariski found that executive pay has gone up 400% since the 1970s. And at Dean Foods, after you adjust for inflation, the average employee actually makes 9% less than they would have in the 1970s.
They honestly said they were just happy to have jobs.
Wariski actually traveled to a Dean Foods milk plant to speak with some of those workers.
They said they thought about how much the new CEO, Mr. Engels, makes. They were resentful of it, but for the most part, they were just trying to figure out how to get by, and a lot of them have second jobs.
According to the Federal Reserve, over the past 2 years, middle-income earners, these are families earning around $50,000 a year, saw their net worth drop by 20%. The numbers are even worse for the poorest fifth of Americans. But for the top 1%, it's almost the reverse. They're earning more, a lot more. And economists have different theories as to the economic consequences of this gap. Here's one of them. America's economy has long depended on middle-class consumer spending. It's the engine of our economy. So if 90% of Americans are either seeing their wages stagnate or worse, what happens when the engine starts to sputter, when people can't spend money? That's a question I put to Sarah Bloom Raskin, the Federal Reserve governor we heard from earlier.
Combined with widespread unemployment, you know, housing and stock market declines, increasing rates of mortgage defaults, foreclosures and bankruptcies, the assets of many American families have been significantly eroded. One consequence of this is we want to understand better how inequality is growing through both a fall in the bottom as well as a rise in the top.
If this gap continues to grow, could you conceive a future where there is a relatively small middle class in America, a middle class that is not necessarily able to sort of drive the engine of the U.S. economy, which traditionally, of course, has been consumption?
I think that that's something that needs to be looked at carefully. I mean, clearly, there have been studies showing that growing levels of income inequality are associated with increases in crime, profound strains on households, lower savings rates, poorer health outcomes, diminished levels of trust in people and institutions. And those are all trends that I think are forces that have the potential to drag down maximum economic growth.
That's Sarah Bloom Raskin. She serves on the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve, and she spoke to me from her office here in Washington. Governor Raskin, thank you.
Thank you.
A Harvard economist named David Moss studies income inequality. And 3 years ago, he had a breakthrough.
Well, there was a chart that I had created back in late 2008, looking at bank failures from the 19th century up to the present. And an interesting pattern emerged, which was they peak up in crisis years, which occurred fairly often. Then they peak up, especially in the 1920s. But then most striking, after 1933, when we saw the introduction of federal financial regulation and banking regulation, these banking crises disappear almost completely, so close to zero you can almost not tell the difference. And then it continues very, very low until the early 1980s. Then they pick back up again. Anyway, so I made that chart.
So he had his chart of bank failures. And, of course, the 1980s marks a point of a return to deregulation. A few months after making this chart, one of David Moss's colleagues mentioned a similar chart, except one that looked at income inequality. And he asked Moss,
"Have you ever thought about how that curve looks almost exactly like this chart on bank failures?" And so we took that curve and we plotted it on the same page with bank failures. And lo and behold, it was a striking connection. So as bank failures started to go up in the 1920s, inequality was going up in the 1920s. And as inequality came down in the 1930s, bank failures came down and stayed down. They both stayed down together through the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. Just about the time we see financial deregulation, up they both go. Inequality goes up and bank failures go up together. Who knows exactly what's causing what there, if anything, but there was certainly quite a remarkable coincidence.
So there is, in your view, a correlation between income inequality and financial failure, economic failure.
I think there's probably some connection, although, again, I wish we knew for sure. But there are a lot of hypotheses, and some of them may well turn out to be true. There are a lot of people looking at, is there a connection between especially extreme inequality and economic growth? Does it cut down on demand? Do we see spending not as vibrant, especially coming out of a recession when inequality is high? Do we see more borrowing? Do we see more risk-taking? Some people suggest, I think there might be something to this, that as you get higher inequality, up at the top, there's more and more resources in order to lobby Congress and so on, and you get more deregulation of key sectors, including the financial sector. The more you do that, the more the inequality rises and on and on. And so those are, I think, some of the things that we should be looking at and trying to understand.
How would you suggest narrowing that gap? I mean, is it just a matter of getting the economy back up and running as it once was?
Well, getting the economy up and running is a big part of it. As many people say, we need to think about education. How do we make sure that we're doing a good job of education all across the spectrum? But then there's some things that aren't talked about too much. My guess is if you say, why did inequality come down so much after the 30s, a very large role was the war. The war brought people together across every income, ethnic, other class. I think that probably led many executives, for example, at leading corporations, just to not even think about asking for the kind of salaries that are now typical. I think that gradually that sense of cohesion has begun to atrophy, has begun to break, and now people feel much more comfortable asking for the kind of salaries that they're getting at the very, very top end.
Harvard economist David Moss. Writer and historian Jeff Madrick recently wrote a book about how we got here and where we might be headed. It's called The Age of Greed.
In the 1970s, there was an assault on government oversight and regulation. It was followed through time and again over the ensuing years. And eventually, the financial community stopped playing by the rules. There was an economic theory that kept justifying what they were doing. And the American public were not fully aware of what was going on.
Why is the income inequality gap a problem, in your view? I mean, what does it matter if there's a gap? I mean, does it affect everybody?
Well, you know, we should think of it not only as a gap. In fact, we should think of it more as stagnation of wages. And stagnation of wages really bothers me. The typical male worker today, in the middle of the pack, the median, makes less today, less, discounted for inflation, than the typical median worker made in 1969. The idea that people make the same or less today than they made 40 years ago is a stunning historical fact.
Has the idea of greed, has it become a patriotic idea in the minds of most Americans?
I think it's become acceptable. It's become even something to be proud of. I doubt it's a patriotic or American thing, but I suppose you're getting to an interesting point. Do we think it's part of our heritage? It would be dead wrong to think so. Self-interest is central to a free enterprise system. But greed implies something else. Greed implies making so much money you're willing to violate the rules. And that begins to undermine the economy, undermine prosperity, and most important, undermine the potential for economic growth.
Economic historian Jeff Madrick, author of The Age of Greed. He also notes that the gap between rich and poor in America is now wider than Cameroon, Nigeria, India, and even Egypt.
Our last word in business today is penguin politics. People in South Korea have been upset by reports that the U.S. plan to ban the entry of one of their most beloved citizens. His name is Pooro. He's a cartoon penguin, a blue bespectacled penguin, and he wears an aviator's hat.
He has mesmerized kids in Korea and more than 100 other countries. Mesmerized already. Now the producers want to bring the series to the United States, but their desire raised concerns over the penguins' connections to North Korea. Turns out some of the production was in past years outsourced to North Korean animators. The United States bans imports from the communist North.
Well, never fear. U.S. Treasury officials have now decided the cartoon is not subject to an import ban, and they say the penguin will have no trouble flying, maybe make that waddling, through U.S. customs. That's the business news on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The historian Richard White wrote a book about the late 1800s. He did so during the recent housing bubble, the financial crisis, and the Great Recession, and all those modern-day events began to seem familiar.
In many ways, as I wrote this book with these things going on, the early 21st century seems so late 19th century to me.
Much of America as we know it evolved in the 19th century, as we'll hear in three conversations this week. We're talking with writers who seek out new ways to understand old events. Richard White explores businesses that brought you the American economy as we know it. They are the corporations that built transcontinental railroads. From the east toward California. From the 1860s onward, they built one strip of tracks after another across mountains and deserts. You've heard the stories, the Chinese and Irish labor, the brilliant engineering that unified America. That is not the story that Richard White tells. What was the image at the time that people had of these transcontinental railroads and the image that has been passed down through history?
Well, the ideal image of the transcontinental railroads is they're this tremendous technical feat. It connects San Francisco with the Missouri River and on to the East Coast. It makes the nation one. And it's the ultimate triumph that comes out of the Civil War.
Virtually the 19th century version of the moonshot or something like that.
Essentially, yes. I mean, it'll be used, it's still used that way today. In many of the presidential campaigns, both President Obama and I think Newt Gingrich refer back to the transcontinental railroads as this great national triumph.
And you write that to an extent that was true, but you argue that there was a different reality. What was the other reality of the Transcontinentals?
The other reality of the Transcontinentals is they are built way ahead of demand, and it will be 30 or 40 years before many of these railroads are needed. They bring about a great deal of political controversy and corruption. They yield environmental damage. They are conceptually grand, and in practice, they really amount to being disasters in many respects.
What do you mean when you say corrupt?
What I mean corrupt is that it establishes a kind of networking between politics and business that persists to this day. And essentially for me, corruption is quite simple. It's the trading of public favors for private goods. And that's what happens repeatedly with the railroads and the federal government.
Were businesses not entwined with the federal government in the same way before the Transcontinental Railroads?
There are no businesses like the Transcontinental Railroads. One of the remarkable things about this is that this is the invention of the modern corporation. This is why railroads are so feared. It's the first time that Americans come face to face with a new way of organizing the economy on a scale that they had never seen before. And the result of this is not just going to be political corruption, but they think an intervention into the economic lives of ordinary Americans that frightens them.
I want to draw a distinction here because listeners to this program, some may recall that we interviewed a biographer of Cornelius Vanderbilt, one of the great Eastern railroad magnates of the 19th century, who was a major force in inventing the modern corporation. But with these Western railroads, you argue that something else happened because of the way that they were so closely linked on and dependent on the United States government.
Yeah, what the Western railroads, particularly transcontinental railroads, would not have been built without public subsidies, without the granting of land, and more important than that, loans from the federal government.
Why not?
Because there's no business there. There's absolutely no reason to build them except for political reasons and the hope that business will come.
Because it was largely empty country, at least empty of white settlers at that time.
What we're talking about is 1,500 or more miles between the Missouri River and California, in which there are virtually no Anglo-Americans. Most railroad men look at this, including Vanderbilt, and they want nothing to do with it. And that's why it's going to be built by largely promoters.
I want to mention a name who comes up in your book. When I was a kid, I loved books about railroads, and I read some book that talked about Grenville Dodge. And the story that I learned from a book long ago about Grenville Dodge was he was a Civil War veteran. He was a great engineer. He was involved with the Union Pacific, part of the first Transcontinental Railroad. And he was the guy who brilliantly discovered a pass through the mountains that became part of the key route of the Union Pacific. It's a heroic story. He's a little different in your book.
He's very different in my book. He's an impressive guy, and certainly he tells wonderful stories, including the story of finding that pass. And I'm not the first one to point out that that pass shows up nowhere in his actual contemporary accounts. It's not in his diaries. It's not in his letters. It's a story that he makes up later. And that's what Grenville Dodge is very good at, making up wonderful stories about Grenville Dodge, which is not to say he's not a competent engineer. I mean, the problem with Grenville Dodge is that he is surprisingly competent at times, and at other times he represents the worst of the Gilded Age. He is corrupt. He's a politician. He will go out and become a lobbyist for the Union Pacific and for the Texas Pacific. What he is very adroit at finding ways in which he can get public favors for private railroads.
And you see more signs of the corporate lobbying yet to come. And corporate lobbying techniques, he claims credit for inventing some of these techniques.
Oh, he really does. What he realizes is that lobbyists themselves have limited ability to gain what they want if they operate only in Washington, D.C. They have to appear to be channeling real public desire for whatever it is that they're advocating. And so what Dodge does is go back out and organize publicity campaigns. He will solicit editors. He will solicit local prominent people to write their congressmen. So he makes it appear that what the Union Pacific wants and the Texas Pacific wants is what local people want. But all of this uproar of popular opinion has really been engineered by Grenville Dodge.
This has a name in modern parlance. It's sometimes called grassroots lobbying when it's legitimate and astroturf when it's completely financed from afar and made up.
And this is astroturf. I mean, one of the things that the 19th century realizes, and it's a critical thing for the railroads and other corporations, is this has already become what we call an information society. It's controlling information, controlling financial information, seeming to produce popular initiatives. All of this are things that are mastered in the 19th century. The rise of the Associated Press, the Telegraph, these are critical to what goes on.
So was Grenville Dodge, in addition to whatever skills he had as a railroad engineer, the Thomas Edison of astroturf lobbying?
In many ways, he was. I mean, it's easy when you're writing about these people to despise them, but it's also tempting to admire them. They're inventing, in many ways, our modern world. This is the first time that they're seeing many of these things, and they see them fresher than we do. They realize that they're making it up as they go along, and I learned an awful lot from watching them do it.
Richard White is the author of Railroaded, The Transcontinentals and the Making of Modern America. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
We're getting new views this week of old events, 19th century moments that influenced the country we live in today. Tomorrow we'll talk about the very shape of this country, the series of random misunderstandings that created the border between the United States and Mexico. This is NPR News. It's pretty common that at a time of bad news, Americans are uplifted and inspired by a sporting event. What was distinctive over the weekend was that at a time of bad economic news, Americans were inspired by a women's sporting event. It was the Americans' come-from-behind victory over Brazil in World Cup soccer. The final score in that weird soccer way was a 2-2 tie, with the United States winning 5-3 on penalty kicks, which sounds pretty darn dramatic. NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman watched the game, and I understand you had heart trouble, Tom.
I did. I had some palpitations. I got over them, but listening to you right now, they're back.
Well, what made this game so great? The score sounds astonishing. Obviously, it can't get any closer, but what made this rise above even that?
We don't have time to talk about everything, so we'll focus on the thing that'll be replayed over and over and is being replayed over and over. It's the end of the game. The U.S. was trailing 2-1 down to the last minute of the second overtime, meaning the U.S. was a minute away from getting dumped out of the tournament. So the Americans are also down a player after one of their starters got ejected for committing a foul. Then midfielder Megan Rapinoe, on the run, launches a high-arcing pass from the left side of the field. The ball came down just out of reach of the Brazilian goalkeeper. Keeper fully extended. Abby Wambach, the veteran star forward for the U.S., jumped high, snapped in a header for a tying goal. Stunning play. And then they go into this penalty kick shootout. The fired-up U.S. made all five of its penalty kicks. The American goalkeeper, Hope Solo, a great goalkeeper, came up with a big diving save on one of the Brazilian penalty kicks. USA wins.
Which explains why the Twitterverse and everything else across the country seem to be lighting up with excitement about this game.
Oh, my goodness. I especially love some of the comments from a live web chat during the game on sportsillustrated.com. One said, "Awesome. The guy down the hall in my barracks in Afghanistan lets out a huge scream with each U.S. goal or save just before I see the posts on here." Another said, "Cheers in Rwanda for USA." Then this one, "I'm now an official women's soccer fan, period." And Steve, there was this interesting comment on ESPN from U.S. coach Pia Sundhage, an obvious insider with this team, but here sounding like an outsider looking on in awe.
"I come from Sweden. I got opportunity to coach this wonderful team, and somebody's writing this book, and it's something about American attitude and find a way to win. Unbelievable."
That's the U.S. head coach Pia Sundhage, and Tom, her team found a way to win in spite of some calls that went against them.
Yeah, there was a lot of bad officiating. It's safe to say the head referee blew several key calls. The biggest one was when the ref kicked out USA defender Rachel Buehler for fouling Brazilian star Marta in front of the U.S. goal. Now, it might have been a foul, did not seem to warrant a red card, though. And then on Brazil's ensuing penalty kick, which Hope Solo blocked, the referee ordered a re-kick because either Solo moved before the kick or a U.S. player ran toward the goal too soon. FIFA, the international governing body, said Solo moved forward off the goal line, but the consensus was if she did, it wasn't really any more than any goalkeeper does. The Brazilians scored on their second try, and that really turned the crowd against the Brazilians for the rest of the game.
In any case, though, the calls that went against the U.S. did not stop the U.S. from victory, so what's next here?
What's next is the semifinals against France on Wednesday. And then if they win that, and they certainly do seem like a team of destiny right now, they will play the winner of the Japan versus Sweden semifinal. And the U.S. may win its first Women's World Cup since 1999.
NPR sports correspondent of Destiny, Tom Goldman. Tom, thanks very much.
You're welcome.